Welcome to Supernatural Podcast Episode 14 for Home, which originally aired in the U.S. on November 14, 2005. And let's jump right into the recap. It opens in Lawrence, Kansas. A woman and two young children move into the Winchester's old house. The woman is looking at a wedding picture, and her young daughter tells her that there's something in her closet. The woman goes up to the bedroom, which happens to be Sam's old nursery, and finds nothing in the closet. Back downstairs, she hears noises and goes down to the basement to find the source. A spirit on fire opens the girl's closet door and walks towards her, and she screams. It cuts to the house, and the woman is banging on the window in terror. Sam is forced out of the dream, and the next morning we see him drawing trees on the motel stationery. Dean is telling him about some possible jobs. A fishing boat found off the coast of California and the crew has vanished. Also, a string of cattle mutilations in West Texas. Sam is not paying attention. So Dean says, "Am I boring you with this hunting evil stuff?" He's annoyed. Also, a Sacramento man shot himself in the head 3 times. "Any of these things blowing up your skirt, pal?" Dean says. It's a reference, of course, to the famous Marilyn Monroe scene of her standing over a vent and her skirt is blowing up. Sam tells Dean that they have to go back to Kansas. "Okay, random," Dean tells him. The tree that Sam has been drawing over and over, which kind of reminded me of Lucas in Dead in the Water when he was drawing the circles over and over, is the same that is drawing outside of the old house, or growing outside of the old house in Lawrence. And Sam finally confesses about his dreams and the dream about the woman and their old house. Dean is overwhelmed. "First you tell me you have The Shining, and then you tell me I have to go back home? Especially when I swore to myself that I would never go back there." But they go to Lawrence to check it out. They go to the house and the woman answers the door. Dean is about to make up some lie, as usual, and Sam stops him, telling him the truth. She tells them about the box of photos she's found, and with some hesitation she lets them in. She tells them about a laundry list of issues with the house. Flickering lights. "That's too bad. What else?" Dean asks her. And the scratching, and of course the young girl tells them about the figure on fire. Okay, now they freak out. They decide to do some research into the house, like they would with any other job. Sam asks Dean how much he remembers about the fire. And Dean says, "Not much. I remember the fire, the heat, and then I carried you out the front door." Sam never knew about this. It's a great brother bonding moment. In fact, they have several through the episode. Dean excuses himself for the restroom and he calls Dad when Sam is not looking, leaving a message asking for help. It's very apparent that he's barely holding it together. Cuts to the house and Jenny has a repairman with her. "Okay, the next time you see a monkey playing the cymbals and it starts to play all on its own, do not put your hand in the garbage disposal. It is not pretty." Cuts to an auto body shop, and they talk to a man, Gunther, who knew their dad, and talks about how stubborn he was and how he hated to lose. Their dad claimed it was just a short circuit that caused the fire, then got obsessed with the supernatural and visited a palm reader. The boys locate a handful of palm readers and psychics in town, including Missouri Mosley. The name rings a bell with Dean. Looking at John's journal, they see the message, "I went to Missouri and learned the truth." Dean always thought he meant the state, not a person. So they go and see Missouri, who's played by Loretta Devine. Let me just say, I love Missouri. She may be my favorite non-main character of the show. The scene is classic and my favorite of the whole episode. She knew who they were right off the bat. "Let me look at ya. You boys grew up handsome, and you were one goofy-looking kid, too." The final comment was directed at Dean, whose eyes widened when she said it. So for the next part, I'm going to do a couple of role plays. It has some great dialogue in between Missouri and the boys. So I'm going to play Missouri, and my friend here is going to play the male characters. Sam, "Oh, honey, I'm sorry about your girlfriend and your father. He's missing."
"Sam, how do you know all that?"
"Well, you were just thinking it just now."
"Dean, where is he? Is he all right?"
"I don't know."
"Don't know? He's supposed to be a psychic, right?"
"Boy, you see me sawing some bony tramp in half? You think I'm a magician? I may be able to read thoughts and sense energies in a room, but I can't pull facts out of thin air." Sam grins, highly amused, and so am I. They sit down and we have another great interaction. "Boy, you put your foot on my coffee table, I'm going to whack you with a spoon."
"I didn't do anything."
"You were thinking about it." Sam mentions that he thinks something is starting. Again, it goes back to the resurface of the ceiling demon and Meg's possession and all that. An increase in supernatural activity. Coincidence, or is it the ceiling demon, one of the highest level demons, and his activity is stirring all other supernatural activity? Answers I hope we'll get in season 2. Meanwhile, back at Jenny's house, she leaves the youngest child alone to investigate noise upstairs, and the latch on the playpen is released, as well as the latch on the refrigerator. Little Richie climbs into the fridge to get his juice cup and is locked inside. Convenient, no shelves, and arranging the food in the fridge to leave room for Richie. Must be the spirits doing. Yeah, that's it. Just as Jenny finds Richie, there's a knock at the door. It is Sam, Dean, and Missouri.
Listen, Jenny, it's important.
Ow!
Missouri whacks him on the back of the head. Give the poor girl a break. Can't you see she's upset? Forgive this boy. He means well. He's just not the sharpest tool in the shed. Missouri tells them there are two spirits in the house. When real evil walks a house, it leaves wounds, and sometimes wounds get infected. The house is a magnet for paranormal activity, and there's a poltergeist, a nasty one. They make gris-gris sachets to put in the north, west, south, and east corners of each floor. Punching holes in the drywall. Jenny's gonna love that, Dean says. As Missouri is describing the purification, Dean tastes the angelica root and makes a grimacing face, like a baby tasting something sour. I love it. Missouri sends the family away so they can work, and here we see a nod to Final Destination. The lamp cord attempts to strangle Sam, a bureau is slid across the floor pinning Missouri, and Dean is nearly impaled by half a dozen knives, which he shields with the dining room table. Cue the dark music. Dean rushes up to save Sam. It cuts to the destroyed kitchen. It looks like a tornado ripped through it. Missouri says it's over, but Sam is not so sure. Jenny turns out the light and starts to fall asleep when her bed begins to shake violently, a reference here to The Exorcist. Luckily, Dean and Sam are waiting in the car to be sure that the family is all right. Sam sees Jenny banging on the window, just like in his nightmare, and they rush in to help. Dean tells Sam to grab the kids, and he will help Jenny. Jenny's locked in a room, and the fire spirit is after the little girl. Dean and Jenny are outside, and Sam comes down the stairs with the two kids. Okay, Sari, take your brother outside as fast as you can, and don't look back, Sam says, and gets pulled back by the spirit. Dean takes his axe and chops away at the door. Reference number two to The Shining here, when you see Dean's face through the door from the inside like Jack Nicholson in the film. Sam is getting beaten up. Dean enters and is about to shoot the spirit, but Sam stops him. The figure on fire is their mom. She walks up to Dean and says, Dean, then to Sam and says, Sam, I'm sorry. Sam asks her what she is sorry for. Their mom's spirit attacks the poltergeist and destroys it with her own spirit to save her sons. The next day, Dean is looking at the pictures and thanks Jenny for giving them to him. Missouri tells Sam the spirits are gone, even their mom. Sam asks her why it's happening to him, and she does not have answers. Just then, Dean calls him to leave. They say goodbye and drive off. So it cuts to Missouri arriving home. She says, that boy, he has such powerful abilities. Why he could not sense his own father, I have no idea. And we see John in her living room. John says, Mary Spirit, do you think she really saved the boys? And Missouri answers yes. John looks at his wedding ring. John Winchester, I could just slap you. Why don't you go talk to your children? He replies, I want to. You have no idea how much I want to see them, but I can't. Not yet. Not until I know the truth. And we come to the end. So let's move on to the analysis. The WB hyped this episode as The Journey Home, but the title is really Home, although there's been a lot of confusion on that. I really like this episode. It was one of the best of the season, and it's great as a rewatch as well. In fact, I just rewatched it twice, and it was still just as good both times. But the best part of the episode was the interaction with Missouri and the boys. The character of Missouri is based on Zelda Rubinstein's psychic character Tangina Behrens in the 1982 film Poltergeist. I'll discuss this film on my Darkgate Horror podcast, but if you've not seen the film, I recommend it. I've seen it numerous times since its release in 1982, and although it's not perfect, it is a fun ride. I'm really hoping we see more of Missouri in Season 2, especially since Meg will not be around. Both characters added some humor and good banter with Sam and Dean. Plus, Missouri can provide some mentoring to Sam to help him with his powers. We saw some of this already at the end of the episode. And the first time I saw this episode, when we see John sitting in the living room, you get this eureka moment. It's like, oh my God, he is alive. You know, it's the first time we've seen John since, you know, the original, you know, in the pilot where we see back from the 80s. But, you know, it's really interesting to see that John is really alive. He's just been avoiding the boys. And we later find out it's because he notices the increase of supernatural activity, and he goes after the ceiling demon, and he wants to keep the boys safe. So he feels the only way is to hide from them and actually do the job. And, of course, we know how that all plays out at the end of the season. But this was the first time we really get an idea of what's going on with John. So, pretty cool. And I just want to bring up, at the end of the episode, where we see Mary and she says that she's sorry. So I'm going to just discuss the topic of why is she sorry? When she approaches the boys, she looks at Dean and says, "Dean," and looks at Sam and goes, "Sam, I'm sorry." And then Sam says, "For what?" But then Mary explodes, kills the poltergeist and all that. But did we ever find out what Mary was sorry for? I've always thought Mary was an innocent victim of the demon. Perhaps she's not so innocent. So I've looked around on various fan communities on LiveJournal, and I've thought of some of my own ideas, and I've compiled a list of possible answers. Of course, this is not inclusive, but these are just the few that I've thought of right now. Number one, for not being a mother to Sam. Dean had 4 years with her, Sam had none. You know, granted, Dean was only four, so it wasn't a lot of time, but he did have some with her. I chalked it up to her meaning that she just wasn't there. She has to know all of this, their course in life, Dad's obsession because of her death, even though it's something at this point we think is uncontrollable. The boys did not have a normal childhood. She had very little time and just had to say something to her boys before she sacrificed herself yet again. Number two, but that's a silly reason or, you know, thing to be sorry for, although it's not her fault she was killed, or so we think. There's more to this than meets the eye, something that hasn't been revealed yet. Kripke has alluded that we'll find out more about Mary's background, because we really don't know anything about her at this point. Number three, what if Mary knew about Sam's powers and knows how hard it will be for him? Maybe she has had people in her bloodlines with abilities and felt kind of responsible for him having them and also for having lost Jess. She's sorry about the current pain in his life and what's to come. Number four, it's always nice seeing Mary as a constant that sort of kept the boys running, but how scandalous would it be if she's actually part of the demon mess too? Number five, it never helps that right after that part, Missouri says the same thing to him, but at least she explains herself. Number six, it's been said that the original pilot script, Mary had something, has said something when she ran into the nursery that suggested she was familiar with the demon. Number eight, Dean's a special boy too, but Mary made some sort of deal. Perhaps the amulet comes into play somehow to protect him. The demon came for Sam instead, and Mary blames herself. I don't buy this one, although we do not know the history of Dean's amulet or anything about Mary. Kripke said that the amulet is important and we'll find out the significance eventually. Number nine, she's sorry that the only time she was able to speak to Sam was to protect him from a poltergeist, destroying her spirit in the process. But Mary is gone and will not be able to visit them in the future, so perhaps that's why she's sorry. So, let's move on to the legends and reference section. I am going to talk about ghosts, poltergeists, and hauntings, but I'm going to focus in on California hauntings. There are a wide range of haunted places in California, and many of which I've been to. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about those locations in particular. So there are many different types of ghosts, or, spiritual beings, of course. And there are many different explanations for the many experiences that people have reported through time regarding hauntings. Ghosts and hauntings seem to be a relatively common part of the human experience. They appear to be several types of ghosts or hauntings, and more than one theory may be needed to explain them all. So the first one is dead people. The traditional view of ghosts is that they are spirits of dead people that for some reason are stuck between this plane of existence and the next, often as a result of some tragedy or trauma. Many ghost hunters and psychics believe that such earthbound spirits don't know they're dead. Veteran ghost hunter Hans Holzer says, quote, "A ghost is a human being who has passed out of the physical body, usually in a traumatic state, and is not usually aware of his true condition. We are all spirits encased in a physical body. At the time of passing, our spirit body continues into the next dimension. A ghost, on the other hand, due to trauma, is stuck in our physical world and needs to be released to go on." So ghosts exist in a kind of limbo in which they haunt the scenes of their death or locations that were pleasant to them in life. Very often, these types of ghosts are able to interact with the living. They are, on some level, aware of the living and react to being seen on the occasions that they materialize. Some psychics claim to be able to communicate with them, and when they do, they often try to help these spirits to understand that they are dead and to move on to the next stage of their existence. Number 2, residual hauntings or recordings. Some ghosts appear to be mere recordings on the environment in which they once existed. A Civil War soldier is seen on repeated occasions staring out a window at a house where he once stood guard. A dead child's laughter is heard echoing in a hallway where she once played. There are even cases of ghost cars and trains that can be heard or seen sometimes, even though they are long gone. These types of ghosts do not interact with or seem to be aware of the living at all. Their appearance and actions are always the same. They are like spirit-level recordings or residual energies that replay over and over again. A traumatic moment in time leaves an indelible impression on the building or area and replays itself for eternity, says Strange Nation. This could be anything from a glimpse of the past, a recreation of some traumatic or emotional-laden event, or even footsteps up and down a hallway. What causes these recordings to be made and how and why they are played back is a mystery. How and why past events are recorded and replayed repetitiously is not understood, writes Lauren Forcella. Whatever the actual mechanism, it apparently possesses longevity as the encore performances of a haunting can continue for decades or longer. Generally, the haunting is a fragment or portion of an actual event. Number 3. These kind of ghosts or messengers may be the most common. These spirits usually appear shortly after the deaths to people close to them. They're aware of their death and can interact with the living. They are most often bring messages of comfort to their loved ones, to say that they are well and happy and not to grieve for them. These ghosts briefly appear, and usually only once. It is as if they intentionally return with their messages for the express purpose of helping the living cope with their loss. This category commonly involves one-time visits to someone with whom the apparition has close emotional ties, says Lauren Forcella at Paranormal Investigations, who calls these ghosts crisis apparitions. Although the encounter usually seems to be a type of farewell, sometimes important and useful information is relayed to the viewer. Though dying is the most common crisis, other life-threatening situations can also trigger apparitional visits. Number 4, poltergeists. Everybody's favorite. This type of haunting is the most feared by people because it is the greatest ability to affect our physical world. Poltergeists are blamed for unexplained noises such as wall banging, rapping, footsteps, and even music. They take our possessions and hide them, only to return them later. They turn on faucets, slam doors, turn lights on and off, and flush toilets. They throw things across rooms. They have been known to pull on people's clothing or hair. The malevolent ones even scratch and slap the living. It is because of these sometimes mean-spirited manifestations that poltergeists are considered by some investigators to be demonic in nature. Other investigators, however, believe that poltergeist activity is not caused by ghosts at all, but by certain living people under stress. During a poltergeist experience, writes Lauren Forcella, the agent, in an attempt to relieve emotional stress, unknowingly causes the physical disturbance using mental forces. The mental mechanism that allows the poltergeist agent to unconsciously cause these physical disturbances is called psychokinesis. And I will talk about psychokinesis in a later episode. Number 5, projections. I'm speaking from the skeptic's point of view here. If we are willing to admit there is anything to haunting experiences at all, is that the ghosts are in the minds of the believers or are products of our own minds. Ghosts are psychological phenomena that are seen because we expect to or want to see them. A grieving widow sees her dead husband because she needs to. She needs the comfort of knowing that he is all right and happy in the next world. Her mind produces the experience to help itself cope with the stress of the loss. Since we know so little about the power and capacity of our own minds, it's possible that they can even produce physical manifestations, such as apparitions and noises, projections that even others may be able to see and hear. But they are not real in any sense, says a skeptic, just the conjurings of powerful imaginations. Thanks to the diversity of Netflix, I had the opportunity to watch an interesting British documentary called The Ghosts and Witches of Old England. Not a terribly good film, but some of the legends told were interesting. They were a bit heavy-handed on the sound effects and reenactments, but here are a few tidbits that I learned from the film. The first is about Dickens. It was thought that wandering spirits of the dead could not make an appearance on Christmas, and this led to the telling of ghost stories on Christmas. Needless to say, when Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol, he changed the genre forever. Dickens also wrote three short ghost stories, which I found on the internet as free ebooks, but I have not had a chance to read them. Perhaps I'll talk about them later. And most likely I'll talk about them on the other podcast. The second is the area of Cornwall. Now, this area is in England, and it's supposedly a very mystical and haunted area. Locals claim that the mine tunnels are haunted by knockers. Miners would leave some food or drink for the knockers as a symbol of reference. Knockers are named by the knocking sound they heard in the tunnels by ghost prospectors who helped the miners find elements. If you do not leave something for the knockers, you could find, you won't find any takings, and perhaps you could be injured. The rest of the stories describe specific locations or buildings which are haunted, and the story behind the haunting, such as the Bath Royal Theatre and Harpington Hall. The latter story was particularly interesting to me about the conflict of the Church of England and Catholicism, and how the priests had to go into hiding. If they were found, they were executed for practicing the religion, since it was banned in England at the time. And I noticed many parallels with the Holocaust and the Underground Railroad during the U.S. Civil War. So let's talk about haunted San Diego. Now, California has had its share of haunted locals. San Diego is known as one of the most haunted cities in America, and I lived there for 5 years before moving to San Francisco just 1 year ago. While I was in San Diego, I had the opportunity to visit many of the reputedly haunted places. Now, the first is the Whaley House. This is a very well-known location, and I will put links to all of the articles on the show notes. Few houses in San Diego are as historically important as the Whaley House. In addition to being the Whaley family house, it housed a greenery, the county courthouse, San Diego's first commercial theater, various businesses, including Thomas Whaley's own general store, a ballroom, a billiard hall, a school, and a polling place. Significant events such as the seizure of the court documents and records in 1871, the suicide of Violet Whaley in 1885 profoundly affected Thomas and Anna Whaley. These events, as well as the hangings which occurred on the property before the house was constructed, have suffused the Whaley House with an air of mystery and added to its reputation as something more than just California State Historical Landmark No. 65. According to the Travel Channel's America's Most Haunted, the house is number one most haunted house in the United States. The alleged hauntings of the Whaley House have been reported on numerous television shows and been written up in countless publications and books since the house first opened as a museum in 1960. Although we cannot state positively that the Whaley House is haunted, the voluminous documentation of paranormal occurrences at the site makes a compelling case. But if there are ghosts at the Whaley House, who are they and why are they here? The earliest documented ghost at the Whaley House is Yankee Jim. It's James, a.k.a. Santiago Robinson, who was convicted of attempted grand larceny in San Diego in 1952 and hanged in the gallows off the back of a wagon on the site where the house now stands. The local newspaper reported that he kept his feet in the wagon as long as possible, but was finally pulled off. He swung back and forth like a pendulum until he strangled to death. That's very pleasant. Although Thomas Whaley had been a spectator at the execution, he did not let it dissuade him from buying the property a few years later and turning the building into a home for his family. According to the San Diego Union, which is the newspaper, soon after the couple and their children moved in, heavy footsteps were heard moving about the house. Whaley described them as sounding as though they were made by the boots of a large man. Finally came to the conclusion that these unexplained footfalls were from Yankee Jim Robinson. Another source states that Lillian Whaley, the Whaley's youngest daughter who lived in the house until 1953, had been convinced the ghost of Yankee Jim haunted the old house. A visitor to the museum in 1962 mentioned that the ghost had driven her family from their visit there more than 60 years earlier. Her mother was unnerved by the phantom walking noises and the strange way the windows unlatched and flew up. Many visitors to the house have reported encountering Thomas Whaley himself. The late June Reading, former curator of the museum, said, "We had a little girl, perhaps 5 or 6 years old, who waved at a man who was standing in the parlor. We couldn't see him, but often children's sensitivity is greater than an adult's." However, many adults have reported seeing the apparition of Mr. Whaley, usually on the upper landing. One has said that he was clad in frock coat and pantaloons and face turned away from her so she could not make it out. Suddenly it faded away. The specter of Anna Whaley has also been reported, usually in the downstairs rooms or in the garden. In 1964, Mrs. Whaley's floating, drifting spirit appeared to Regis Philbin, the television personality. "All of a sudden I noticed something on the wall," Philbin reported. "There was something filmy white. It looked like an apparition of some kind. I got so excited I couldn't restrain myself. I flipped on the flashlight and nothing was there but a portrait of Anna Whaley, the long-dead mistress of the house." Other visitors have described seeing or sensing the presence of a woman in the courtroom. "I see a small figure of a woman," one visitor said, "who was of swarthy complexion. She was wearing a long full skirt reaching to the floor. The skirt appears to be calico or gingham, small print. She has a kind of cap on her head, dark hair and eyes, and she is wearing gold hoops in her pierced ears. She seems to stay in this room. Lives here, I garner." None of the Whaleys fit the description, but the house was rented out to numerous tenants over the years. Perhaps the mysterious woman in the courtroom was one of these. Another presence reported by visitors in Dawson's is that of a young girl who is usually found in the dining room. Psychic Sybil Leake encountered the spirit during a visit in the 1960s. "It was a long-haired girl," Sybil said. "She was very quick, you know, in a longish dress. She went to the table in the room and I went to the chair." Urban legend has it that this ghost is a playmate of the Whaley children who accidentally broke her neck on a long-hanging clothesline in the backyard and whose name was either Annabelle or Carrie Washburn. There are no historical records about a child dying this way at the Whaley house, nor is there any record of any family named Washburn residing in San Diego at the time. It's believed that the legend was perhaps started by a one-time employee of the Whaley house in an effort to add to the house's mystique. Even animals aren't left out of the singular occurrences. A parapsychologist reported he saw a spotted dog like a fox terrier that ran down the hall with his ears flapping and into the dining room. The dog, he said, was an apparition. When they lived in the house, the Whaleys owned a terrier named Dolly Varden. The Whaley house stands silently watching over San Diego Avenue, as it has done for a century and a half. Everyday visitors come from around the world to tour the historic museum. It contains so much history within its walls that even the non-believer will enjoy the tour. For believers and skeptics alike, the house draws them back time and time again in search of these elusive ghosts. I had the opportunity to tour the Whaley house at night on a tour that they no longer offer, but it was about ghosts, and we went to various locations in town, and it was really spooky in there. Granted, it was around Halloween, and it was a good time of year, and the tour groups were small, and we had a really great guide, but they did point out certain areas, and being one who I've actually had some encounters with ghosts long, long ago, I had the same feeling, that the hair rises on your arms, and there are cold spots in the room. It's very bizarre, and even for people who were skeptical, felt kind of weird in that house. So if you're ever in San Diego, go check out the Whaley house. It is open to the public as a museum, of course. I don't know how often they do night tours, if at all, but just the history of the building itself is fascinating. The second place is Villa Montezuma. This house is supposedly haunted by at least three ghosts, which are said to be the former first owner, Jesse Shepherd, a phantom woman, and possibly a former servant or butler. Jesse Shepherd was born in Birkenhead, England, in September of 1848. To many, he was a musical genius. He drew large social crowds wherever he played. He had many wealthy friends in both Europe and America and was often stay as a guest in their houses. He was also a big believer in the supernatural and was a spiritualist. Shepherd was said to hold seances at the Villa Montezuma during the 2 years he owned it in attempting to contact spirits of the deceased. Music was his key to tapping into supernatural energies. The house passed from owner to owner until finally becoming property of the San Diego Historical Society in 1970 and is now a museum. Since the Villa's creation in 1887, there has been one oddity. That oddity is that a great deal of its owners have met financial ruin upon the purchase of the house, this making the Villa cursed, in a sense, to many. Could this be coincidence or have some shred of truth to it? Since belonging to the Historical Society, no such bad luck has been seen to befallen on anyone. The third is the William Heath Davis House. Constructed by William Heath Davis in 1850, the house remains the oldest structure in Newtown, which is now downtown San Diego. The house is a pre-framed lumber saltbox family home from the East Coast shipped to California by boat around Cape Horn. Davis, who has never lived in the house, died in relative poverty. The spirit of an unknown Victorian woman, however, still resides there. In 1977, San Diego newspaper article featured interviews with the occupants of the house at the time, who reported stories of the lights going on and off by themselves. What's even more unusual about it is that the house was not wired for electricity until 1984. The lights that went on and off were either gas or coal oil lamp flares, requiring a match to light. A Victorian woman has been seen at or near the top of the stairs leading to the second floor, wearing a long skirt with petticoats and high-button shoes. With most encounters, visitors reported seeing the woman from the waist down only. Once, a tour guide coming to start a tour found the group already staring up the stairs. Several in the group stated that a woman in full costume standing at the top of the stairs had invited them to come up. There were no guides in costume that day, and there was no one upstairs at the time. The next one, and many of you, I'm sure, have heard of this hotel. It's called the Hotel del Coronado. It's one of the most beautiful and luxurious hotels in San Diego. It's featured in movies all over the place. It's amazing and very expensive. However, it does have its share of hauntings, primarily the story of Kate Morgan. The elegant Hotel del, as we call it, was opened in 1888 and soon became a favored destination for people from all over the world. It's not long after the hotel's opening that our ghost story starts. Tom and Kate Morgan were a married couple who rode the trains in the late 1800s. Their occupation, con artists. Kate was apparently very attractive and would lure men into a game of cards with her brother, Tom, so that they could prove their worth. Tom would swindle them out of whatever money they were willing to part with, and this is how the Morgans made their living. In November of 1892, however, Kate discovered she was pregnant and wanted to stop the train racket and settle down. While the two were riding towards San Diego, they had an argument because Tom did not want to change his lifestyle. Tom disembarked at either Los Angeles or Orange County. He was supposed to meet Kate in San Diego for Thanksgiving. Kate continued on to San Diego and checked into the Hotel Del under the name Lottie Anderson Bernard. There she waited for Tom, but Thanksgiving came and went with no sign of him. She checked other hotels in the area but could not find him anywhere. It is known that while Kate was waiting for her missing husband, she ventured into San Diego and bought a gun. It was shortly after this that Kate was found shot in the head on some steps leading down to the beach, an apparent suicide. For years, everyone accepted the death as a suicide until 1990 when Alan May, a lawyer who specializes in murder cases, published the book The Legend of Kate Morgan, The Search for the Ghost of the Hotel del Coronado. By the way, they sell this book in the signature shop at the hotel. May pored over records at the time of Kate's death. He came to the eventual conclusion that Kate did not kill herself but was murdered by her husband. There are several pieces of evidence supporting this theory, and most compelling is which the fact that the bullet in Kate's head was of a different caliber than the one in the gun she bought. So, let's talk about the ghost of Kate. The room Kate checked into was 302, which is now room 3312. But that is not the only haunted room. 3502, which was once a maid's room, is also considered haunted. Both rooms have experienced odd functioning electrical equipment, lights turning on and off, etc., and cold breezes. Maids report that objects are moved around by unseen hands. Guests in the rooms, or those who are brave enough to stay the night, have experienced oppressive feelings and curtains that move even when the windows are closed. Other people swear they've heard murmurings coming from somewhere in the room. Kate's ghost has been seen walking down the hallways of the hotel and standing at windows. According to Alan May, an electrician told him that the light over the steps where Kate died will not stay lit. The bulb is replaced constantly, but the lights always go out. May also claims that while he was staying in one of the haunted rooms, he saw a face on the television, which of course was turned off at the time. The sighting was supposedly verified by one or two hotel employees. Room 3502 has a history of its own. Apparently, the maid who was living there during Kate's stay may have become friends with Kate. What is known is that the day after Kate's funeral, the maid disappeared. There is some speculation that Tom Morgan may have killed the maid as well as his wife. One story even theorizes that when the hotel staff found the maid's body, they removed it so as not to further upset the guests. And the final haunted San Diego area place is the Julian Hotel in Julian, California. The town of Julian, nestled in the hills of San Diego County in California, was founded in the 1860s by a small group of adventurous men on their way to San Diego, or so the story goes. Soon after its founding, gold was discovered and Julian became a boom town. In fact, it was a very populated town. The pinnacle of gold production occurred in the 1870s, and after that, Julian started becoming more famous for its delicious apples than its gold. Today, visitors can tour an old gold mine, sample the famous apple pie, and then retire to the Julian Hotel for a night with the town's resident ghost. During my years in San Diego, I made an annual pilgrimage to Julian in the late fall for Mom's apple pie and to enjoy the cool weather. I grew up in a place with four seasons and miss autumn the most. Anyway, back to the story. In 1897, freed slaves Albert and Margaret Robinson arrived in Julian and quickly made it their home. They bought a building that had previously been used as a bakery and tavern and turned it into the Hotel Robinson. Many of the townsfolk were still prejudiced against black people when the Robinsons first came to Julian, but with their hard work and dedication, the couple eventually won over most of the residents. The Hotel Robinson was a great success, being a natural stop for people going to and from San Diego. In June of 1915, Albert died and a controversy was astir. Albert's remaining family, including his wife Margaret, wanted to bury Albert in the town cemetery. They felt that after his long service to the town, such a burial would be deserved. Some of the whites in town felt differently. The cemetery in Julian was whites only, and eventually it was decided that Albert must be buried out of town in a cemetery with his own kind. Thus, Albert was delivered a final insult, and is generally agreed that this is what caused Albert's spirit to linger on in his old hotel. After Albert died, his wife ran the hotel until she sold it in 1921. Eventually, the building fell into the hands of new owners and was rechristened the Julian Hotel. For years before the new hotel opened, people spoke of a violent haunting in the former Hotel Robinson. There was talk of balls of fire speeding around in the hotel, glimpsed through the windows. Glass was shattered and pieces of furniture were moved randomly about. Supposedly, an exorcism was eventually performed and the spirit seems to have either left or calmed down. Much of the ghostly activity seems to center around Room 10, Albert's old room. Strange happenings have often been reported by maids working in the hotel. Freshly made beds unmake themselves, or an impression of someone sitting on the bed is found when no one else was in there. Albert evidently smoked a pipe, for the smell of pipe smoke is a common occurrence. The hotel's non-smoking. Sightings of pipe smoke and even Albert himself smoking have been reported. In Albert's room, furniture has moved itself back into its original position after being moved by the owners. Cold spots and slamming doors have also been reported. Windows in the rooms open and close by themselves. Albert must have a playful side, for he's known to hide objects from their owners. Downstairs in the hotel, there is activity as well. Some people hear footsteps on the second floor above them when no one else is about. On the stairs, the sound of descending footsteps are heard, and some have even seen the shade of Albert passing by the stained glass windows adjacent to the stairway. A story has been told of a menu floating in midair. The new owners of the hotel apparently do not want to make their ghost famous, for they downplay the reports of ghostly activity. Luckily, Albert doesn't seem to mind. So there are just a couple other haunted California locations I'd like to mention. The first is the Winchester Mystery House in San Jose, California. I mention this because many fans of Supernatural wonder why Kripke named the characters Winchester. Is the name due to the gun of the same name or the Winchester House? The Winchester Mystery House was built by Sarah Winchester, the widow of William Winchester, who was the son of a man who founded the Winchester Rifle Empire. After William died, a psychic in Boston told Sarah that the spirits of all the people and animals of those who had been injured by the Winchester Rifles would seek to avenge their deaths. The only way to appease the spirits, said the psychic, was to build them a house. As long as the house was being built, the spirits would not haunt Sarah. In 1884, Sarah moved to California and purchased an 8-room farmhouse in San Jose. Then she began to build. For 38 years, until Sarah's death in 1922, carpenters worked 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, to build the strange monument to the spirit world. At the time of Sarah's death, there were 160 rooms in various stages of completion in the house. However, it's estimated that over 600 rooms were built and then tore down over the 38 years. Every night, Sarah would go to her séance room to receive messages from the spirits telling her what she should build. The orders from the spirits resulted in strange constructions, such as doors that open into walls, stairs that go nowhere, a cupboard that only has a half inch of storage space, and tiny doorways and hallways just big enough for Sarah, who was 4'10" and of slight build, to fit through. Some other interesting features of the house include its 10,000 windows, including some priceless Tiffany stained glass, 47 fireplaces, and a beautiful garden. Sarah had a fascination with the number 13. Many features in the house were built in sets of 13 or multiples of 13. For instance, in the 13th bathroom, the only one with a shower, there are 13 windows. One of the sinks has 13 drainage holes. There are 52 skylights, and the grand staircase has 13 steps. 13 palm trees line the driveway. As a final gesture, Sarah's will was divided into 13 parts and signed 13 times. Two other numbers favored by Sarah were 7 and 11. There is one staircase in the house which has 7 steps down and 11 steps up. Another, called the switchback staircase, turns 7 times and has 44 steps but only goes up 9 feet. Some speculate that stairs were built so low because Sarah had arthritis. Others think she had built them that way to confuse and or slow down the spirits. In the courtyard, there was a hedge shaped like a crescent moon. Mysteriously, the hedge points to the bedroom where Sarah died. At midnight every night, the bell in the bell tower was rung to summon the spirits. At 2 a.m., it was rung again as a signal for the spirits to depart. The rest of the day, the bell lay silent, although other sources say it was used to call servants during the day. The tower was only approachable from the outside by climbing onto the roof of the mansion using a ladder. The bell was hung at the top of the tower with a long rope hanging down a sheer, unclimbable wall. The rope was attached or reached through underground tunnels, the precise layout of which was known only to the bell ringer and his assistant. The great San Francisco earthquake of 1906 trapped Sarah in a bedroom. Because she slept in a different room each night, it took the servants over an hour to find her. She took the earthquake as a sign from the spirits that they were discontented with the way the construction was going. To appease the spirits, she had the front 30 rooms boarded up, and they were never used again during her lifetime. She also slept in the same bedroom, the one where she died, every night thereafter. When Sarah died in 1922, word spread throughout the house, and there were still spots visible where the workers stopped hammering the nails halfway in. After her death, all the furniture in the house was auctioned off. It took 8 weeks, 6 truckloads a day, to remove it all. Later, the mansion was restored and opened to the public. Interestingly, they offer night tours by flashlight on the Friday the 13th and on Halloween. So let's talk about the Queen Mary in Long Beach. Now, I've been fascinated with ships and shipwrecks my whole life. I'm particularly interested in ships of the Edwardian Age, which was the turn of the 20th century. And the Queen Mary is such a ship. Retired now, after a long career, she is permanently docked in Long Beach, California, just south of Los Angeles. I have seen her, but have not been on board. There are many legends surrounding the RMS Queen Mary, and here are a few. In the engine room, door number 13, on July 10, 1966, during a routine watertight door drill, an 18-year-old man was violently crushed in doorway number 13 in the depths of the engine room. Numerous sightings have been reported by both visitors and crew members who describe a young bearded man in blue coveralls walking the length of the shaft alley, oftentimes disappearing by door number 13. It is no coincidence that he was wearing a similar outfit that fateful day on July 10th. The first-class swimming pool, no longer in use, has been the location of many ghost sightings. There have been reports of women dressed in vintage bathing suits wandering the decks near the pool, the sound of splashing and trail of wet footprints leading from the deck to the changing rooms. Although no drownings have been documented, this location has been described by experts as the vortex for the paranormal activity aboard the ship and allows ghosts from other realms an entrance to the Queen Mary. The Queen's Salon, which is the former first-class lounge, has been the backdrop for many sightings, yet the details of the story rarely change. It seems that a beautiful young woman in elegant white evening gown is often seen dancing alone in the shadows. One of the most chilling sightings occurred when a little girl on a tour pointed out a woman in white. Looking around, the tour guide saw nothing. However, the little girl insisted and kept pointing to a corner of the room. The guide still did not see anything and continued on with the tour. The little girl continued to repeat her observation, not knowing that she was just one of many to make the same report. Then there's the Grey Ghost. The Queen Mary was painted a camouflage gray and transformed into a troop ship and nicknamed the Grey Ghost during World War II. The Grey Ghost proved herself as a more important member of the Allied forces, and Adolf Hitler offered a $250,000 reward and the Iron Cross to any submarine captain who could sink her. While performing a routine zigzag pattern, she sliced the British cruiser HMS Curico in half. Over 300 British soldiers went down with the Curico. 40 years later, a television crew left their audio recorder running overnight in the exact location where the two ships have collided. As the tape played back the next day, incredible sounds of pounding could be heard. Others have claimed to hear voices and blood-curdling screams from the same area. The first-class suites. Many occurrences have taken place there within the confines of a number of the first-class staterooms. There have been reports of running water in the middle of the night, the phone ringing at early hours of the morning, and lights suddenly turning on in the middle of the night. Passengers have reported hearing heavy breathing and people tugging on their bed covers, only to realize there was no one in the room with them. One such event happened early one morning as a tour guide was taking interior photographs. One picture, which captured the cabin's beautifully tinted mirror, was taken from across the room. When the photos were developed, the particular print featured the reflection of a tall, dark-haired man in the mirror. This would not be considered very unusual, except for the fact that the man in the photo was wearing a 1930s-style suit. It did not resemble the picture-snapping tour guide in the least. The third-class children's playroom. Lee Travers Smith died a few hours after birth, but was not without heroic attempts by ship's surgeons to save his life. There have been many reports that late at night a baby's cry can be heard from the room that once was the site of the third-class children's playroom. So there you have it. There are some of the more famous California hauntings. I invite you to take a look at more, and there are some really great books written on them. I'll bring up a few probably here and there from other ghostly sightings across the country, including Urbans and Myths around Lawrence, Kansas, where this all began. But let me talk about a couple other things they've mentioned in the episode. They talked about palm readers and psychics. Sensitive to the aura of a person, psychics are able to access information from the emotional, physical, and spiritual parts of the auric field, which contains all the information about a person's life. Psychics use their natural gift to be aware of body language, facial expressions, etc., and from that they can compute potential events and make plausible predictions. Able to sense on a purely material level, psychics are not able to tune into the spirit world except by accident. All mediums are psychics, but not all psychics are mediums. They use tarot cards, runes, palmistry, etc., and other divination tools to take such readings. So hoodoo is based on elements of voodoo, which is an Appalachian folk magic and related traditions. Hoodoo is a 200-year-old practice of magic, and a gri-gri bag is a type of hoodoo charm. Often hoodoo, voodoo, and so forth are found in the New Orleans area and areas of Louisiana. Gri-gri bags are a small cloth bag that people carry for good luck or to ward off evil. Usually contains a mixture of one or more of the following herbs: oils, stones, bones, hair, nails, and other personal items. In New Orleans, the traditional headquarters of American voodoo, as I've mentioned, many people carry gri-gri bags for protection, but they can also be used to cause someone bad luck. Angelica root, also known as Holy Ghost root and Archangel root, is believed to be a very powerful guardian and healer, also provides strength to women. It is used by many to ward off evil and bring good luck to health and family. Some might even keep the root near their baby in a white flannel bag. If put in a blue flannel bag with lavender, this root is thought to bring peace to a marriage. In America, it is commonly found in African-American mojo bags prepared for protection from evil, for uncrossing, and to prevent a jinx. In powdered root, the angelica root is an ingredient in sachet powders used for healing and blessing. It may also be dusted on magic candles used for protection and prayer in matters of spiritual peace and blessing. Van Van oil is an old hoodoo formula for oil, incense, sachet powders, and washing products that are intended to get rid of evil, provide magical defense, change bad luck to good, as well as strengthen other charms. It is the most popular of the New Orleans hoodoo recipes. As a good luck enhancer, it is closely associated with both the rabbit foot and the lodestone. Let's talk about crossroads. Now, crossroads are widely linked to magic and are said to be haunted by various entities who take joy in confusing travelers. The meeting and parting of ways can also be used to conjure up the same spirits who appear there. Also, the shape of the crossroads can be used in protection against these spirits who appear at crossroads every All Hallows Eve, and at other times it can be conjured up to appear there. Also, the very shape of crossroads is in some lore protection against spirits allegedly to haunt the places. And in this episode, Dean mentions cattle mutilations in Texas. There are thousands of cases in North America where cattle have been found mutilated under abnormal circumstances. Marked with fluorescent paint, drained of blood, cows have been found dead with the cause of death unknown. These cattle have laser cuts and certain organs surgically removed from their bodies, often their reproductive and retinal organs. Pleasant. Not only will scavengers not touch the carcasses, but abnormally high radiation levels have been found around these areas as well, with zero trace of footprints, but clamp marks suggesting the cattle were taken from habitats to that area. Okay, so there were no songs played in this episode. I think that's kind of weird, but it happens. The song of the night is called For You. It's by Season Stream. I've wanted to play this song for a long time. I just haven't found a good episode to match it up with. And I think this one might be it. So enjoy.
Come on. I did it all for you. Entertain a kiss. Is all I'd ever need. Is all I get for him. Why did you walk away? Baby, you control everything. 'Cause I love the way your body tastes. Probably. Come on and tell me another lie tonight. Tell me everything's alright. Look into these transfixed eyes and you'll yours. I did it all for you. Entertain a kiss is all I'd ever need. Is all I ever need. For you, entertain a kiss is all I'd ever need. Is all. Another day goes by, cannot believe I'm still with you. Took it all away. The sky that is darker than the night. It took a lot of weight.
So that's it for tonight, my friends. Have you heard any good stories lately? Any supernatural type occurrences in your area? Let me know at supernaturalpodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, have a great week. Thanks for listening, guys. Thank you for listening to the Supernatural Podcast. You can visit my website at supernaturalpodcast.blogspot.com or send me an email at supernaturalpodcast@gmail.com. Please note that the opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host and not of the producers of Supernatural or the WB. The music brought to you tonight is from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.